History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to ask a few questions and then listen to those memories as they emerge. Our goal is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, not only do we become educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we end up inspired, especially when we compare the challenges in our lives with the ordeals so many of these men and women endured. I trust you had a meaningful Thanksgiving with the ones you love, and I know one item on the list of things to be grateful for every Thanksgiving at the Lloyd home in Placitas, New Mexico, is that 77-year-old Jim Lloyd survived through the night on August 6, 1972, and somehow made it out alive on August 7th. A few months back, we met the helicopter pilot who was awarded the Navy Cross for rescuing Jim 50 years ago, and on our last episode, we heard the beginning of this saga from the pilot's point of view. We're going to let Jim recap some of that here just to set the stage.
So I finally got one of my two radios out of my flight gear and called up Art, who was overhead. Of course, he knew from when you eject, you send a beeper coming off your seat. It goes on every radio frequency. It tells him that I got out, but it doesn't tell him if I made it out or if I'm killed on the ground or whatever. And I told him I was alive. And I had literally people 6 feet and look, stop and look right at me, and I'm in the open, and they wouldn't see me. Anyway, when I had a chance, when they move around looking, I called him up, told him I was alive. He said, Lieutenant Commander Bernie Smith, who was our ops officer, was another tremendous pilot, was inbound to help him. So Bernie, I could hear him on the radio calling me on my little handheld radio, but he could only hear static when I called back. So he said, Jim, Mike, key me in. Left, two, right, one. And well, he had his lights on, and he's flying low and very fast, and everybody was shooting at him. I was really surprised. Not only there were more people there than I thought, but there were also, seemed like everybody had some kind of a firearm. And they were shooting at him, and Mike did keyed him in, and then when he was overhead, I told him, okay, you're overhead now. And he was either being painted by radar from a destroyer or one of the E-2 surveillance planes that we had flying over the Gulf or the South China Sea. They never went overland. He told them, and they're watching him, so they had a rough idea where I was. We didn't have any of the fancy gear we have today with GPS, satellite imaging, or any of that kind of stuff. And then I told him to turn his lights off. I didn't want any company down there. They told me that a helicopter was coming in. And I looked around. I wanted to get out of there so bad. I was emotionally a wreck. And I'll get into that in a minute. But I told him, I said, there's no way a slow mover is going to survive this. And so I said, turn them back. I'll have to call him, went in later. I got to move. I was going through shock. You know, 1 minute I'm flying an airplane. It was comfortable cockpit, familiar cockpit, and shower and an hour and a half away. And now I'm in the enemy's backyard. I was 150 miles north of DMZ, 21 miles in from the coast, in an area I was told when I got back that no Americans were ever seen again that went down that area. Wide open spaces and people all around. I decided I had to move. And so I told the A-7s, I said, my thinking was, bomb on the other side of the rice paddies. One of them went in, dropped 2 500-pounders, and they were just tremendously loud. I'd seen them going off, obviously, from the air for almost half a year, but boy, on the ground, they were terrifying, the noise and the shockwave. But the light scared me the worst because it lit me up. I could see people, faces and everything all around me looking that direction. I said, knock it off, it's not going to work. I had been in that area for about an hour, and I, like I said, it was probably 9:30, 10 o'clock at night now, and I had to get out by daylight. There's no way somebody like me could hide in the daytime. So I'd been watching 11 North Vietnamese about 40 yards from me, and the reason I know there are 11 of them is I assigned each one a number so I could keep track of them, because I don't want to get on the radio and have one or two of them close by and hear or see me. When they all be clumped together, I talked lowly on the radio. Well, I made sure they were all clumped together, And I said, I got to move north. And the only reason I went north is because it just seemed to be quieter. So I slowly snuck away, leaving the voices behind me. When they disappeared to silence, I took off at a dead run. And I went up probably an eighth of a mile, maybe a quarter of a mile, and got down to call them and tell them I was on the move. And I made an almost fatal mistake. I took my two survival radios, two water bottles, took them on my survival gear, my vest, because the vest was making all kinds of noise, and I dumped the vest and tucked the water bottles and the radios in my Anna blackout suit and my pant legs, and they'd slipped out, all of them. And without a radio, there's no rescue. And so I slowly turned around, and I worked my way back. There was clumps of grass and all over the place. There was people all over the place. Well, I used the voices of those 11 men that I left behind to vector me into the same little spot, the same little clump of grass that I'd been hiding in. I couldn't see. It was so dark. And I groped around with my hands, and my right hand came across the stronger of the two radios. I would have taken either one of them and retreated a second time.
And let me stop you here, because this is the part of your story that I think gets me the most. And I'm interested to hear from you later which element of it is the most mind-blowing to you. But as I try to put myself in your shoes, if I've left this hiding spot behind, I'm trying to get away from these guys, it's pitch black, I have no idea where anything is, and then I realize I lost my radio. I don't think I would have had any reasonable expectation or hope of recovering it in that situation. What told you that you could actually do this and go find that radio again?
You know, that's an interesting question, because at the time, I just figured I'd find it. I look back through the years, and that's one of those what ifs that really, really I find scary, because I can't imagine going the rest of the night without a radio, knowing that daylight is, it was like being executed at dawn. When the sun came up, you were gone. And there was no hope for rescue. Any of the sound of the planes would disappear, because they would assume that I was either killed or captured, and they're not going to risk any more planes in such a dangerous area if they don't have any confirmation that I was still alive and still free.
So that moment when you're groping around in the dark and your hand grabs a hold of that radio again, what emotionally, what did that feel like?
Well, it was obviously a feeling of relief. If that was the end of it, that would have been even really a greater relief, but it was just the beginning of the next steps. But at least I had hope. And I never, never left that radio again. I didn't tuck it anywhere. I never left my, I didn't even switch hands with it. I had a grip on that until the last minutes in North Vietnam. So I continued moving, and I'd be out in these rice paddies, and the water is probably 8, 12, 24 inches deep. It varied. Real slimy bottom, real slimy. And I'd fall down in the water, make all kinds of racket, and I'm moving away. There's people around, but not right around me, because I'm moving away from them. And I just wanted to get out of there. Heading north, I had a little wrist compass. I thought, I can't do this. It's just making too much noise. I got to find some way to travel quieter. Well, I realized that these partitions between rice paddies are a few feet wide, and they're high and dry. And I got on those, and God, I could make a really good time. I was quiet. I'd be hunkered down low to look up against the dark sky to see any light clothing so I could see anybody that might be approaching before they see me. And I was doing this for close to an hour when I heard, I was in the middle of two rice paddies, and I heard voices coming, noise. And I looked back, and two soldiers were on the same partition I was on, walking toward me. And I couldn't run. If I got in the water, they'd hear me splash. I just crawled to the side as far as I could of that little partition. I laid down in the prone position, held my breath, and I prayed. And I felt them walk by me. Then they stopped. A question was asked in Vietnamese. They walked back, and they stood over me. And then they jabbed me in the back with a rifle. And that is a feeling I can't even put in words of how hideous that feeling is. Again, Sear taught me I didn't want to be caught. And I was in a bad situation before, but I was free, and it was all over. And the thought came to my mind, I'm okay. I didn't know I had injured my neck, but I was still very mobile. I'm just going to lay here. They're going to have to carry me. Well, they jabbed me a second time, and when I didn't move that time, they argued. They started arguing. And then I heard which I thought was one running off, and then I could hear another group of soldiers about 40 yards off. I thought the individual was running too. And I figured now is my only chance. There's one guy standing over me. So I mustered all the courage I can get, and roll over as fast as I can to grab the guy's gun, fully expecting to be shot. And I was alone. And I remember my feeling was 95% relief and 5% foolish. I just thought, what if I just laid there not knowing they were gone? They had both run off not knowing, thinking that I was going anywhere, and I went, probably they were competing for credit. Well, they only went about 40 yards and told the guys that they found my body, I guess. Well, I got up and took off, and I ran down that partition. They couldn't see me, but they could hear me, and I could hear them shooting, and they all were firing in my direction. And the bullets were random. I guess some of them came real close to my ears, other ones thumping in the mud. I got down to the end of the rice paddy, and they were chasing me on the same little partition. I made a 30-degree angle cut, and they went straight, and I lost them. All I said on the radio was, "You can't believe what I just went through." So I had to continue going.
Let me stop you there for a second, because we can't believe what you just went through either. And there's a couple elements of that I want to add to. So you said the two Vietnamese soldiers, you believe, were arguing over credit, because they could be rewarded financially if they brought you in.
I was told that we were, as officers, we were worth $500 if we were captured alive. You know, that's a lot of money for them. I like to think I'm worth a little more than 500, but hey, I can't argue. But anyway, and again, because they jabbed me in the back and I didn't react. So they figured I was incapacitated. So they weren't worried about me escaping.
But we know that he did, with a little help. It's time for our first break, but we'll pick up Jim Lloyd's remarkable survival story when we come back. You'll find photos and a short video with Jim at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. Over 1,500 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our captivating conversation with decorated Navy pilot Jim Lloyd, one of just 161 downed airmen recovered from behind enemy lines during the Vietnam War. He needed a series of miracles to survive his ordeal 50 years ago. Shot down, he made it to the ground in the dark with enemy all around, and when we left off, he'd been discovered by the enemy, a rifle pushed into his back as he lay face down on the ground. And you mentioned how awful that feeling was. Can you help describe that for us, what it felt like when they jabbed you in the back? It's more than physical pain you're talking about.
Oh, yeah, it's emotional. It's a feeling of being caught and, you know, by the enemy. You know you're going to be in the mercy of the enemy. They could do whatever they want to you. I knew in that area that I was a little too far from Hanoi Hilton. I probably wouldn't survive. I wouldn't be around much longer. They'd probably just execute me right there. And so I just figured it was over with. I had nothing to lose. That's why I was able to roll over, you know, get the courage to roll over and face that gun and hopefully knock it to the side and see what happened. I had lost my .38, unfortunately, when I took off my survival vest. And as it turned out, that was probably a good thing because they would have hurt it. But at the moment there, I wish I had it. I remember thinking about that. And then I just, like I said, I just took off at it. I can't believe how fast I was able to run to get away from all that.
And one more question before we move on to the next element of this saga. You said as you're lying there face down in the mud, they're jabbing you in the back with a rifle. But you said something. You said that you prayed. And I'm always fascinated by this. And maybe you don't even remember what you prayed. But when guys describe a situation like this, I try to say, well, what would I pray in that moment? What does a guy pray when he's in that helpless and seemingly hopeless of a situation?
Well, obviously, I'm praying for something good to come out of it. In other words, not to get killed, not to be captured, whatever. And I'm an average person when it comes to religion. I certainly believe, but I'm not somebody that pushes my beliefs down other people's throats or any of that kind of stuff. But the old saying is there's no atheist in a foxhole is very true. Your situations that by then I felt I was being looked after. I mean, there was no way that the decisions I made and the situations that happened would turn out in favor of me consistently like that, even up to this point. And it continued all night.
Yeah. And thank you for going there with me, because that fascinates me. And maybe other people get a hint of this in their life where they end up against something that they have zero control over. And I mean, if there's ever a situation where you're not in control, even though all these decisions you made led to your survival, it sounds like that's where you were in that moment, that there's not much else you can do and you need some help beyond yourself.
There was absolutely nothing else to do but roll over or, you know, and it was maybe my prayers were answered and it gave me the courage to roll over. Maybe I wouldn't have done that. And, you know, years later, decades later, I think back of that. And I think, what if I didn't get the courage to do that? I just lay there. Of course, they'd all be right there and got me. You know, and here I had a slim chance. And somehow I had the ability to take advantage of it. So it was good fortune.
Yeah. So you go from face down in the dirt with bayonets in your back to escaping these guys. So now, but you're still not free. And you know that there's only a few hours of daylight left. So what happened next?
Well, I'd be going through these fields. I would say I'm wading through a rice paddy. It's 2 feet deep. I hear off the distance, North Vietnamese. They'd be spread out and they'd be yelling. They'd be banging things. I thought I heard my name being called. I don't know if it was that or it was a Vietnamese word that sound like it, but I want to emphasize the human mind and body is absolutely phenomenal when it's pumped up like that with adrenaline and you go into a life-threatening situation. I could hear everything. I could sense everything. I'd see them coming and I'd hold my breath when they got close, duck down in that putrid water. I'd literally feel them walking by when I couldn't hold my breath anymore. They didn't know I was there. They were looking for me. When I couldn't hold my breath anymore, I'd slowly come up and I'd see them walking away from me. They went by me. Again, one of them could have stepped on me and found me, but that didn't unfortunately happen. And then I would continue on. And I did that several times during the night. I started feeling then as, you know, I may get out of this. There's just too many things that are going my way just for it to end in failure. And I just want to mention the putrid water. The North Vietnamese fertilized those fields with human excrement for centuries. And basically, the analogy I use is I spent the night hiding in the basement of an outhouse, but it was the only cover I could find, and it's certainly the better of the alternatives. So anyway, after a few hours, I was really getting nervous. It was about daylight coming. It was about 2:30 in the morning. I got to a sort of a dry spot, and I pulled out my radio. I heard planes all night. They were flying all night. I called out on the radio, and I said, I think this is as good as it's going to get. It's kind of quiet here. You can go ahead and try to bring the helicopter in. I sat down. I remember slumping down and my adrenaline started leaving me and I literally ached from one end to the other. I was tired. I was worn out. Again, the adrenaline was a real shot in the arm and I was losing it. The 2A7s that were over there flew 5 hours for me and refueled air-to-air, refueled several times to be there for me. And that's a long, long time for a single-seat aircraft that we flew. Now, an A6 Intruder, which is two people, the commanding officer of the squadron, Commander Ernst, and his Lieutenant Commander Grady Jackson, his bombardier navigator, took over command, unseen command, and they were overhead. And I remember saying, go ahead and bring them in. And one of them came back and said, Roger, Jim, it'll be 30 minutes. Just take it easy. And I thought, oh, take it easy. Well, one of three things is going to happen, and two weren't good. One was either in 30 minutes I'm going to be killed, or in 30 minutes I'm going to be captured, or in 30 minutes I'm going to be rescued. And I thought, wow, this is going to be exciting. And I just turned 27 6 days before, and I realized that, you know, there's a good possibility that in a half hour I might not get any older. So that, with adrenaline going, despair started to take over. And I want to just emphasize one thing that I learned. despair is the worst thing that could ever happen to you. That's like, there's no hope. It's all over with. I can't help it. You know, you lose it. Fear, on the other hand, is one of your strongest allies. It hones your thinking, your instincts. You become an animal. As I mentioned, I'm so thankful that I was able to do that. And fear was one of my driving forces. And I found a big difference between the two. Well, despair was starting to hit in. I started to hear planes flying over. They were starting to stack up. They were getting ready to come in. With the sound of the planes, the North Vietnamese would hear that, and they figured that's where I was, so they moved. I had found out when I'd called in, found out later through air intelligence, that I was exactly 2 miles from where I landed my parachute to where I was calling in for the helicopter at that point. I have no idea how many miles, additional miles I made zigzagging to get there. But the fatigue was there. I mean, so when they started stacking up, I started thinking, I don't know how I'm even going to see the helicopter. My helicopter training was in the daytime in the jungle. How was it going to work at nighttime in the open fields with the enemy all around? Well, my questions were answered pretty quickly. The A-6 was leading in. He was bringing in the helicopter. And I want to mention, there was three helicopters from HC-7 holding over the water, taking turns refueling and then holding for the call in. And when they get low, they come back and refuel. They were there for me, waiting all night long. The commanding officer of the helicopter squadron, Commander McCracken, went in and actually got to convince the admiral that he felt his people could do it, because there was a lot of doubt that they could actually pull a rescue off in that part of the country. And so he convinced them, and then he was one of the helicopter pilots. So anyway, they were orbiting back and forth. Big Mother 60, flown by Lieutenants Harry Zinser and Bill Young, Doug Ankeny, Matt Szymanski's were the two gunners in the back. They were ordered in. And they had their problems. They trying to take fuel while airborne off one of the destroyers, and they had trouble with that, so they left there with just a partial amount of fuel. And when they got to the beach, they almost flew into a row of trees until they turned the landing light on when they got nervous about it and avoided that. They flew over a village and got raked with small arms fire, where five rounds went right where one of the gunners, Doug Ankeny, was standing, and it missed them. Anyway, they came in, they're pulling the A-6, and they said to me, Jim, take over vectors. So by then I could see the helicopter. He was lit up. He had everything, his landing light, everything on for me to see him. And they were just hosing him and down. I'd bring him in, and when he was right coming up to me, I was in his landing light. I stood up and gave my cover away, and he flew over. Unfortunately, he didn't see me. The planes overhead saw me, and the North Vietnamese saw me, but the helicopter didn't, and he disappeared. And I'm yelling in the radio, well, he was out of range for me when I was telling him to turn around. The planes overhead heard me and relayed it to him and told him to make a 180, turn back, which he did. Well, he comes in, and one of them says, show a light, any kind of light. Well, just then, pencil flares that we carried popped up all around. They got them from down airmen from previous shoot downs, and they were monitoring the radio. That confirmed it. And he said, which one's you? And I said, negative, none of them. Disregard, I'm turning my strobe on. Don't shoot, don't shoot, don't shoot. It was so on my left shoulder. And I wanted to do is take it off, turn it on, and throw it, say I'm 20 feet to the north or whatever. But there were, I couldn't get it off and off my shoulder, so I turned it on. And I didn't want it to be viewed by the gunners and the helicopter as small arms fire and be shot by friendly fire. Well, he spotted me, and he went off about 100, 200 yards from me and went into a hover, and I just took off. Well, it sounded like I had the whole North Vietnamese army on behind me. My night vision was gone because I was looking in that landing light. I couldn't see him, but I could hear him. And I just, as fast as I could run, he was in a hover. Of course, the noise now was deafening. Again, I didn't have a helmet on. I was getting beat up by mud and rocks. And I hooked on, we had a snap link on our torso harness that we hooked onto the cable. And I hooked on, closed my eyes, and waited to be hauled up, and nothing. And I looked, and the helicopter was sitting right next to me in the mud. He had landed to get below a deflection angle of the AAA gun, a 37 millimeter that was right next to him, and he had to get below it before he was shot down. In fact, one of the A6s overhead later had said they saw that the guns going off and then the lights of the helicopter going out, and they thought they shot it down. Well, the North Vietnamese thought they shot it down too. As I went to jump in the helicopter and with the weight of the cable on top of me, of course, I was completely worn out by then. And then he was holding power to keep from sinking in the mud, so his struts were extended. So it was about neck high, the deck of the helicopter, and I went to jump in and knocked myself the wind out of me. Just then, the gunner looked there. The gunner was standing over me shooting. He stopped shooting, reaches over with his outstretched hand, and I could see his face in the dark. And he's saying, come on, come on. And that, I can say, that image I'll never, ever, ever forget. I could have been on the moon and not felt more any more further away from home. And here, there was this American pulling me in the helicopter. He grabbed the back of my flight suit and pulled me in. In the meantime, since the helicopter landed, turned the lights off, as I mentioned, the North Vietnamese thought they shot it down. And so they were storming the other side, and Matt Szymanski held them off. He said he later, years later, he said, I was laying them down like cordwood. The helicopter took off. I remember it vibrating real bad from the strain of the engines and pulling off. And we had 21 long miles to go to the coast. They were jinking to keep from being hit. You know, I didn't have any safety lanyard on like the gunners did, but I'd be jinking. I was afraid of being thrown out the open door, so I lay on the floor, afraid I'd be get shot to the floor. And I was going through shock again. And one of the gunners grabbed my arm, set me in a seat, strapped me in. Off we went. And right before we got to the coast, two fireballs went about 30, 40, 50 feet from us. They were the SA-7s, the relatively new at the time, shoulder-mounted heat seekers that they went after slow movers. We didn't have to worry about them in jets, but the transports and helicopters had to worry about them, and they just barely missed us. And then one of the gunners grabs my shoulder and points down, and I could see the breakers of the North Vietnamese coastline. We were feet wet. As I say, a savior of the naval aviator. At least if we went down, the Navy would get us if we survived the crash. But we landed on the Cleveland. I didn't even know what kind of ship it was. Shut down, and that's when I met the crew the very first time, who became lifelong friends. And I got out of the helicopter. The commanding officer of the ship and his medical officer came up to shake my hand and jumped back. Like I said, I must have looked the sight, and I smelled a heck of a lot worse. Anyway, we found out we'd had 13 holes in the chopper. The sponson was shot off. There was a crease in the tail rotor, and they had way less than 5 minutes of fuel, which is nothing. I mean, those gauges aren't even accurate for probably 10 minutes of fuel, plus or minus. So that was another miracle. I cleaned up and I debriefed. It was probably now about 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. Got a bite to eat. And then they flew me to my ship. And I debriefed there. The Admiral had me for dinner, wanted to hear all about it. I debriefed him and his staff. They flew me to the Philippines. And I debriefed about 4 or 5 different staffs there before coming back. And everybody kept saying, well, son, you're going home after what you went through. Well, I'd seen it, done it all. I was ready to go home. And then I came back in the right seat of an A-6. Way off the distance, I heard the plane call of somebody calling for his wingman or flight leader that was shot down. Beeper, beeper, come up voice. That's the call, looking for somebody. And I realized that I can't go home. Sorry. I got more flight gear and flew for another 5.5 months. They did a good job of giving me a little easier flights, but I had some exciting times before the cruise was over with, and then came home when everybody else did. And the end of January, flew for had a month off, and then transitioned to the newer A-7 and got out of the Navy, my original schedule, in July of 73.
And I have to ask the question, you know, why? You gave us a taste of it, but why was that so important to you to stay there another 5.5 months, knowing that, I mean, you've just lived through, I don't know how many threats to your life on that one night. You know that you're putting yourself in harm's way when you don't need to. I mean, you had the golden ticket home and you turned it down. Why?
Well, first of all, I didn't know it'd be 5.5 months. You know, we were on an open-ended cruise. In other words, they say, well, it's October, we're going home. And then it wouldn't work out. Thanksgiving, we'll be home. No. Christmas, no. You know, so it wasn't like I knew there was 5.5 months as it turned out, but it probably wouldn't have made a difference anyway. I had learned what the Navy did for me. Our aircraft carrier, our air wing, was supposed to go out of flight ops right before midnight when I got back on my flight. They stayed in the wind and did double duty all night long, flying, launching and recovering aircraft. Our captain was Captain Sanderson, and years later, as a vice admiral, he had told a friend of mine he had 51 airplanes in the air at one time. And I don't know if that's our carrier and the Midway, who were flying all night for me as well, or just our ship. But they were there for me all night long. When I heard that plane call of a guy going down off one of the other carriers, I thought, where am I going to be if they need me? Fat, dumb, and happy at home. And I said, I could not live with myself that way. And so, yeah, it wasn't always easy, but it was the best decision I ever made in my life. One of the most difficult, but one of the best, because I could look back and feel good about myself.
quite a story, isn't it? And we're not done yet with Jim Lloyd. You're hearing his voice, but it's possible you've seen his face a time or two in movies and television. We'll explain when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, coming in on Final Approach with decorated Navy pilot Jim Lloyd of Placitas, New Mexico. If you missed the first part of his story last week, you can pick up that podcast at hometownheroesradio.com, where you'll also find a conversation with one of the men who rescued Jim in the dark behind enemy lines 50 years ago, Harry Zinser.
And you shared with me before we started this interview that the reason you're willing to talk about this is because you want to honor those guys who risked their lives to save yours. And it sounds like, you tell me, but it sounds like there was a almost an overwhelming, humbling emotion that you felt when you realized how many resources were devoted to your rescue.
Yeah, absolutely, I did. I couldn't believe it. In fact, my comment was, I cannot believe the Navy's one for all for one. And it really got to me. It really got to me. I still have message traffic from the different ships and commands that were supplying, if nothing else, just support or whatever. It was all part of the 7th Fleet. And I thought, I never bought another drink again in the Philippines. I was told I was the poster child of morale building, just my presence, by people that, just about the whole 7th Fleet knew what I looked like, even though I didn't know them. But I'd be in the Philippines or whatever for a little R&R, that they would see me. And I was told by this, by our commander, our group commander, sometime later, people would look at you, see you there, having a good time, doing whatever, and be reminded the Navy will do anything that's possible to get you out. It's even 50 years today, I get emotional thinking about how wonderful and dedicated the Navy was for me.
And you hinted at that those 5.5 months that followed that life-changing night weren't exactly a cakewalk. Was there ever a time where, even for a moment, maybe you questioned that decision to stay?
Not so much. Yeah, I guess there was one I questioned. One of the first flights, I think it was the first flight back. I was with a squadron mate, Bill Moyer. We were over North Vietnam the daytime, about where I went down. And I remember thinking to myself, what am I doing here? I prayed to God if I ever got out of here, I'd go home. I wouldn't. And here I am again. And Bill's wife is 3 days stateside overdue. And he has no business here. And just then he took a hit. And the A-7 had 5 spars that held the wing on. And the main fuel tank was in the wing. And he went right through that, took 3 spars out and about an 18-inch diameter hole through the fuel tank. And he was spiraling down with his big white plume of fuel going out. I kicked off my bombs and went after him. We got back. He was able to get the plane under control. We got over the beach, back over water, and I called for a tanker. And he was able to plug in and air-to-air plug in and fly with most of the fuel going out the hole, but enough to keep the engine spooling. And this tanker made a low pass on the ship and pulled out, and he pulled out and landed, and then I came around and landed next to him. And I walked up to shake his hand, and I realized he was flying Alpha Charlie 410. It was, we had our names on our planes. We didn't always fly them, obviously. We just flew whatever was available. But it happened to be the one with my name on it, Lieutenant Jim Lloyd Zeke. And here it was just shot out. But the first day I'm back over the north, I thought, you know, somebody's trying to tell me something, and I'm not doing a good job of paying attention. But so there were some exciting times. And when I hear the warble of a fan song, it would get me really excited. You know, your natural instincts is to run from it. Of course, you're going 500 knots, and the missile's doing 3,000. You're not going to get very far before you're gone. You know, I had to fight those natural fears. Flying the airplane again, it was just a piece of cake for me. I didn't have any fears of it or whatever, because my thinking was the dying breath of that airplane, it kicked me out safely.
And you mentioned a few times, that was another miracle, that was another miracle, that was another miracle. Have you inventoried them? Have you made a count of all the little twists and turns that if they had gone just a little differently, you wouldn't be here?
No, I guess not specifically. I'd say there's about 6 or 8 of them that were really hot, really made a difference. Probably the most difficult of all of them, the two of them, going back for the radio. I had no choice. I mean, the rescue would have been over with if I didn't. So that probably wasn't as, it was scary, and what ifs was very underlined. But the one that was really the hardest, probably of all of them, was rolling over to grab the gun in face of a potential being shot, knowing the guy was standing there. When it turned out, it wasn't. But I could have just laid there and waited until they showed up. That was probably the most difficult. The other ones were difficult, but you know, you do what you have to do. And by as the evening went on into the night, into the early morning hours, I started feeling like, you know, this is being pieced together. This is happening. I may get out of this. It wasn't that I would take chances, but I would be probably more willing to make difficult situations, knowing that I'd made some difficult ones already and made it through.
And again, I want to be careful not to put thoughts in your head and words in your mouth, but one of the things that struck me as I'm listening to all this, and you were very intent on not becoming a prisoner of war because you knew what that would likely mean, and you, in your case, where you were, you probably wouldn't have survived that. But I'm thinking of a lot of the prisoners of war that I've interviewed over the years, and quite a few of them here in New Mexico, including guys that survived the Bataan Death March, very similar circumstances to what you went through. And what always struck me was the perspective they had in life after their ordeal. They never took anything for granted, and some of the challenges they encountered really paled in comparison with what they'd ever been through. Do you see an impact of what you went through that night on how you've lived the 50 years since?
I think so. You know, something as simple as bending a nail and getting mad at it and then realizing that there was one time in your life you had a broken neck in the rice paddies with a gun in your back 150 miles north of the DMZ, and now you're complaining about a bent nail. You know, you have to put things in perspective. And I think about it a lot. But I got some positive things out of it. There's two that really stood out and still stands out and will always stand out. One, when I see the ocean, going feet wet, you know you're safe, at least it's harder for the enemy to get you if you hit the water, and the Navy has a better chance of getting you. So after every mission, when you look at it, first it starts out as a silver line off the horizon, and it seemed forever to get closer and closer, even though you're going pretty fast. And when you make it over there and call the ship and say your feet wet, it's just a tremendous feeling. And when I see the ocean, I get this tremendous sense of calm and safetiness. And the other one is the night. I told my wife, the night is your ally. You know, yeah, you always feel you can't see certain things. Well, whatever you're afraid of can't see you either. I told my two boys when they were little and afraid of the night, I said, the night is your ally. I feel very much at peace and safe in the night as well.
And you mentioned your two boys. I just have to ask, did they already exist when you were going through this, or were they born later?
They were born after I got out of the Navy. You know, no, I didn't have kids. I was married. But, you know, my twin brother has four sons. I have two. My sister has a boy and a girl. And none of them went in the military. Of course, the draft became, you know, a thing of the past long before they were eligible. And I often wonder why they didn't want to go in. And then, of course, I think about, well, both their dad and their uncle, you know, what they went through. Why would I want to take a chance when I don't have to? So I understand.
Yeah, they wouldn't be here if you didn't survive all of that. And, you know, we've focused so much of this on just a few hours that you endured, but those few hours also gave you some friends for life. Can you help us understand what the connection or bond that you've developed with your rescuers has been?
Yes, you know, I don't see them as much as I wanted to, but we get together. It's really, really, really nice. And every August 6th, I try to call them and talk to them. Any chance I get, I talk about them, you know, by name. Sadly, the two gunners in the back are deceased, and the rest of us are getting older. But I got really warm feelings, and we talk like we've been friends for half a century, even though we don't see each other all the time. But when we get together, it's like we live right next door to each other. It's really nice. And there's other friends in that, too, and not just the ones around my rescue, but just people I knew in the Navy. There's a bonding in the military that you really can't compare to anything in the civilian life. Things that come the closest to it are the first responders, whether they're fire, police, medical, or whatever. But it's a warm feeling. I did not join the military with even the thought of I'm joining to become a veteran, but it's one of my most prized possessions.
Well, that may be the answer to a question I'm sure to ask you in a minute here, but I'm just also curious to know, I'm sure our listeners are, I mean, this was 50 years ago. You haven't been sitting around doing nothing for 50 years. You worked for the Forest Service for a long time?
Well, I started out, I got out on GI Bill and got my master's degree. And then I started out with the Bureau of Land Management, Northern Nevada. And then I transferred from there after a few years to Montana for nine years and was there as a fishery biologist for one of the best fisheries in the country of three states. And then I decided I wanted to move up in the outfit a little more than, even though I love that job. And so I moved to Atlanta and became a program manager for the southeastern United States for the Forest Service. There for a few years, and then moved to Washington, D.C., and ran the fishery program for the Forest Service, and then came out to Albuquerque, gosh, 31 years ago, and was a director of Fish and Wildlife for the Southwestern National Forest, and then I retired, and I've been retired 21 years.
And in your retirement, you've had a little fun, too. In fact, some of our listeners may have seen you on the silver screen. Yeah. You didn't think I was going to ask you about that one, did you?
No, I did not. I did not. Well, because you did, my wife, who she's got the looks in the family, over the last few years, she got us into it to do backgrounds for the booming movie business here in the Albuquerque area. It's a lot of fun. You don't know what you're going to be. And dressing up, particularly for Westerns and time era type of programs, are to me the most enjoyable, because you actually do go back into those times mentally, because they're so realistic on detail about how you look, how the sets are set and whatever. So I've been anywhere from a cowboy in the Westerns, businessman on a train that's blown up in the Westerns, and that kind of a gunman in the Westerns, to I was a four-star general and Air Force general in the second Independence Day until the aliens got me. And and then I got roped into being an old man in a rest home, which I didn't appreciate my wife getting me into it. In fact, when she saw me on the sets, we came in at different times, and I'm in these old, god-awful clothes, you know, plaids and checks and slippers and stuff. And one of the, and she was dressed up as a news lady in a suit, and she was at a different time, and she's standing there talking to some of our friends, and one of them said, is that Jim over there? She looks at him and says, no, he's at home. She wouldn't even admit it. So anyway, it's been fun, really fun. And you meet some tremendous actors.
Well, so just for people's points of reference, you mentioned the second Independence Day. What are some of those other credits? So this was not the first Independence Day where they blow up the White House. This is the sequel. But the aliens did what the North Vietnamese could not, and they took you out, huh?
Yeah, they came in through the roof of the building we were in, and that was it. You know, we were all kind of doomed at that point. I was with Patrick St. Esprit. He was my boss in the movie. He was a Secretary of Defense, and I really enjoyed visiting with him. And anyway, he was the first to go. The alien literally picked him up and destroyed him. It was an assumption that we were all dead, and that was it. So. Mm-hmm. But it's fun. I've been in about almost 50.
What are some of the other projects maybe that we'd recognize the name of them?
Okay, Longmire. Now we're in and out of The Cleaning Lady. But Better Call Saul. There's a lot of them the titles have changed. They have a working title, and that's the only ones I'm familiar with, so I don't think the audience would know if they saw them. Mm-hmm. But as I mentioned, you meet some phenomenal actors and actors. Morgan Freeman's phenomenal. Lou Diamond Phillips, very personable. You know, it's just fun. It's a dimension of the movie business I never even knew what it would be like. And it's even better than I thought.
And I have to ask, I mean, at any point, have any of those people ever been made aware of what you went through? Because there's a few hours of your life that would make a pretty compelling movie.
No, you know, not the actors and stuff. Some of the background, we have spent a lot of time together just waiting for our turns and stuff and play cards and stuff, eat meals and whatever. And there's a few of them that are ex-military that we got in discussions and they know about it. But I don't know of anybody beyond that I've shared it with. You know, you're pretty busy on the set anyway, so.
Well, and, you know, this has been 50 years, so you're not that 27-year-old anymore, and we can't ask your twin brother to play you because he's not 27 anymore either. If you had to choose one of those Hollywood actors to portray you in the story of August 6, 1972, who do you think you'd go with?
Oh, geez, that's a good question, because if I say somebody funny, you know, it would make me look really good. And if I said somebody that was pretty impressive, it looked like I'm bragging. But, you know, it's hard to say. I never, ever gave that a thought. They probably have the same actors, both of us. Oh, boy. That's a good question. I have to think about that one.
Well, who knows? It may happen sometime. And people can, if they want to, go online. And on YouTube, there's a documentary where your ordeal from 50 years ago is captured. What's that called?
Okay, that came out as a result of this presentation that I did for the Navy's I was a guest speaker, one of the guest speakers at last year's Tailhook in Reno. It's the first one I've ever been to, where all the pilots of the different eras get together and in a convention, and they have speakers and so forth. And I told my story there, and they were making a documentary on Navy pilots from World War II forward. And there's 14 of us. They had to cut me about half what I said. They did a good job. There's a lot of computerization in it. You'll see me when I was 50 years younger. And I'm narrating myself, and I was really honored for that, because there is some tremendous stories that I was just proud, honored to be included in as part of that. But it's called Legends of Carrier Aviation on YouTube.
Well, I guess if you're a legend, maybe you can play that old guy in the retirement home, huh?
Well, maybe so. You know, it's hard to say, but I'm 77. I really have a hard time passing as a kid anymore. In fact, that's one of the things with being background. I tell people, it might be a shock to you, but I can't play those roles as a high school kid anymore.
Well, I'm sure there's so much more we could talk about, but there's something I don't want to forget to say, and that's thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us an unbelievable story that I'm sure has given a lot of people perspective today. Is there anything else that you think it's important to understand that maybe what you went through taught you?
Well, I would say for anybody, believe in yourself. You'd be amazed at what you could do. And if it's an overwhelming obstacle ahead of you, just remember, if you eat an elephant, you eat an elephant a bite at a time. You just one step at a time to get through it. Believe in yourself. You could, if you really want to do something, you can.
And you made reference something earlier that gives you pride. So that's a question I always like to ask. And most of the guys I talk to are much older than you, and they have a little more to look back on. But you've had 77 action-packed years here. When you take stock of all that, is there something that you would say you're most proud of or most thankful for?
I look back. It's been a great ride, and I'm real proud of the opportunities I was able to do this, because I think our generation probably lived in the best place and the best time in the history of mankind, and given a lot of opportunities, and I really appreciate all that. But when I look back, it's an unconscious decision. It's those years in the military that really stand out, with the good and the bad. I mean, you learn who you are, you test your mettle. Thankfully, not everybody has that opportunity to do that, and you don't want to go through some life-threatening things just to see who you are. But I was happy of my ability, just glad I had the ability to do what I had to do when the chips were down. And I attribute to the large majority of that is through the training that was given to me.
And one last question, then if you have anything else to add, feel free. But I'm just looking at the wall next to us here in your office, and I see a picture of a young Navy pilot. There's some A7 artwork there. There's a reunion of your squadron where everybody signed the sheet. All of your medals are there, and there's a lot of decorations. There's different photos, including from August 6th of 1972 when you got back to the ship after that rescue. I'm just wondering, with all the stuff on that wall there, a saber up there too, is there one thing on there that is most meaningful to you that when you stop and take stock of it, those emotions are really stirred?
Well, there's three. I'm going to say one is a document that was given to me by a retired Navy chief from Hawaii. I didn't know him. He was a gunner on one of the helicopters way back then. And he had a piece of paper. It was handed to him on the Midway. It was handwritten of coordinates where they thought I was and whatever, because he was going on one of the helicopters to my rescue. And in 2005, through a miracle, he found me. He wrote a story on that's on the wall, and the paper is framed. It's a part important part of my rescue. Another one was just given to me by a retired Navy captain just on August 6th of this year. The party my wife had for me in celebration of it. His wife, I guess it's an embroidered or anyway handmade. It says Lieutenant Jim Lloyd, August 6th, 1972. Beeper, beeper, come up voice. And that was what I heard on the radio coming back in that A6 that made me decide to stay. And then the third thing that it really gets to me is that, Paul, you can't read it from here, but that's that gold plaque up there, that gold frame deal. It's my name tag on my flight gear, my name, rank, and the wings. And it's on Velcro, so you can take it off if you have to. And it was on my flight suit. And when I got back aboard the Cleveland, and I got my flight suit back. I figured somebody took it because it was gone, and as a souvenir when they did the laundry. And I thought, well, that's how I got more of them. Well, that was in 1972, and in May of 1999, when I gave a talk years later in Pensacola at the Air Museum of my rescue, they had a bunch of the people that were on there and myself. And one of the gunners, he's, of course, a gray-haired man now, walks up in front of everybody, about 1,500 people in the audience, and hands that to me. And it still had a little mud on it. And he said, "We our tradition is when we pull in a helicopter, as soon as we can, we take your name tag." He said, "I've had this for all these years." And he said, "We're making an exception. And I've given it back to you." And so my wife had it framed, and then the plaque on the bottom says, "Lost, Vinh Sa North, Vietnam, August 6, 1972. Returned, Pensacola, Florida, May of 1997. So those are the three that stand out the most.
And I just have to ask, because you said it still had a little mud on it. How'd that mud smell?
Well, you know, I never got close enough to it to smell it. I just, and now that might trigger some emotions that I don't want if I smelled it. But, you know, I've been real fortunate about that. So far as not having nightmares. So I would want to do something that might change that. I just want to thank you for this opportunity, because it's another opportunity for me to try to recognize those brave men, officers and men that were there for me 50 years ago. Made my life possible, because, you know, when I got back aboard the Cleveland, I had the sigh of relief that I have my life now, at least for now. It might change down the road, but right for now, I got my life ahead of me. And when I'm 50 years down the road looking back, it's more than that, because that life ahead of me is now specific. It's wives, it's kids, it's my career, the fun I had, the events I had. There are actual things that I never would have had if it wasn't for those people. So thank you for that.
An attitude of gratitude, fitting for the season we're in. That is Jim Lloyd of Placitos, New Mexico. Keep an eye out for him in those movies and TV shows. And don't forget to access the photos and a little video with Jim at hometownheroesradio.com or on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes Today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.